Welcome to the Resilience Rising podcast with me, your host, Jen Scottney. With the help of my guests, we will be getting curious about what resilience is, how we develop it, and the times we've used it. This podcast is here to explore all things resilience. Natasha Carthew is a working class writer from Cornwall. Her book, Undercurrent, a Cornish memoir of poverty, nature and resilience, is out now in hardback, with a paperback out in April 2024. She's written 10 books, including poetry, novels for young adults, and her 2021 book, Born Between Crosses, is a sequence of prose poetry celebrating the working lives of working class women. She's known for writing on socio-economic issues and working class representation in literature for several publications, podcasts and programmes. Natasha is the founder and artistic director of the Working Class Writers Festival and the Nature Writing Prize for Working Class Writers. She guest edited the Working Class edition of The Bookseller in 2022 and is the recipient of the Bookseller Rising Star Award in the same year. Finally, Natasha, after many cancellations, I get to chat to you. So welcome to the podcast.
I know, that's brilliant. Thank you for having me. I think this is like seventh time
or something like that. Yes, and not all your fault, my fault as well for having surgery and that was very inconvenient. But
it's good to be busy, isn't it? We've both been busy for different reasons. So
Both dealing with house moves and all sorts.
Brilliant.
Well, as I just said before we started recording, your book Undercurrent was really my standout book of last year. Now I read it when I was away off grid in the Lake District over summer, so thank you for writing that. What a powerful book.
Thank you. It's good to hear.
And I would have asked you on the podcast anyway, just because it's my excuse to talk to people I want to, but you had put the word resilience in the title there. You said that it is a Cornish memoir on poverty, nature and resilience. So I was even more fascinated to ask you on to see why you put resilience in there and what that means to you.
For me, resilience, when you grow up in poverty, when you grow up kind of with so many things kind of lined up against you, I think resilience is the key really to kind of get you over those fences and breaking down those walls. For me as a young kid, I very early learnt to work out what was actually the ways that I could get through the things, the negative things. And my mum was always very kind of strong and resilient too. So as I grew up, I kind of used to think, right, what are the things that I can do? As opposed to things that I couldn't. Obviously, we didn't have any money. We were in rural isolation. So resilience for me, and still now, is literally, it's just, right, look at the positives, because there are often, they're positives, you know, and you might not think them. And because you come from poverty, or you think the world is set up against you, and it's so easy to think, oh, I'm just going to sit back and just think, well, you know, and kind of complain or moan about the things that we can't do anything about. And I prefer to kind of focus on the things that we can do something about, because that's the way through. And that's kind of how I work things into my work as a writer, but also with my class festival work and the Nature Prize, because so many people just, you know, complain, obviously, because they haven't got the cash, or they haven't got the people to help them get through, you know, and help them, give them a lift up. So I always try to say, well, just try and focus on the things that you can do. And it is harder, and things aren't unfair, you know, things, but you've got to push on. You've got to forget about that, because what are you going to do? So resilience for me is literally kind of building on what you have and creating the narrative.
And that positivity that you talk about, is that something that you feel like you learned and had to practice? You said it's not the easy option. Or is it something that you think was given, that your mum comes across so positive in the book at times, like just repeatedly telling you how lucky you are? Is it something that came from her? Is it something that you developed yourself? Or is it something that we're born with?
I think for me, I think it was something I was born with, because, you know, people tell me when I was very young, I was always, you know, if there was any argument, I was always the first to push in front and kind of face up to these bigger kids or whatever. I always had a strong sense of justice. So my resilience was kind of like, yeah, I really do think I was born like it. And then, you know, with my mum, even though we didn't have anything, I was brought up in a very small flat. We had, you know, my mum and my dad for a time lived in the living room and until my dad left, and we had, you know, he was violent, and there was a lot of that, cover a lot of that in the book. But my mum's resilience was, you know, grabbing our hands and pulling us down onto the beach and saying, look where you live, look how beautiful the landscape is. And we would collect seashells and we would collect sea glass. And, you know, those small riches for us poor kids was everything. So in a way, she helped me then with that resilience as well. But as a writer, I've always knew I wanted to be a writer. So that was that for me. So when I left school at 15, I didn't do many exams. I didn't care for that at the time because I just wanted to just get out into the world and write. And in a way, that focus is a kind of resilience as well, because I knew what I wanted and I knew I was going to get it. And people say, you're mad, you know, you need to get a proper job or you need to make money. And I was like, well, I'm just going to do work in factories and have my notepad in my pocket and do what I wanted to do. And that's a form of resilience, because I knew I had to just fight through anything negative, including things people say to you, especially as a young working class writer. People think, oh, you're never going to make it. And that would just be fuel to my fire, because I'd be like, you watch, you know, hold my beer kind of thing, and I'm gonna prove you all wrong. So from a very young age, I wanted to do what I wanted to do, and I think that resilience came from childhood.
It was really striking, that ambition that you had in the book, because it seemed like from every angle everyone was telling you, well, you're just going to be a cleaner or not a farmer because you weren't male. And so where did that ambition come from? Again, was that just something that you think you were born with too?
It was just something I was born with. I've always loved watching people. I've always loved other people's stories. You know, and as a small kid, I would write stories. I would tell stories before I could write, in order to stay up late or in order to just, you know, have a little audience of people. I was always kind of messing around telling stories, but also watching people, watching stories. I think that's so important. That's so key as a child. And then I had this moment of just going down to the sea and looking at the crashing waves and thinking, you know, I want to write this. I feel this. And there was this moment where that wild nature, I realized, was inside of me as well as outside. And then that was that defining moment where I was like, okay, I'm a writer and this is all I can do as well as all I want to do. I mean, that's just that passion, yeah.
And how important is representation? Because it felt like, I mean, I know you talk about that you were able to go to a library and there were a few books, but how important is it is representation? And does that really help with other people's ambition and seeing what they can do if they can see somebody from their background as a writer?
Yeah, absolutely. And that was one of the reasons why I started up the Festival for Working Class Writers, which was in Bristol 2021. And since then, we've worked with the London Book Fair. We've worked with a Women's Prize. We do online events and live events and hook up with all sorts of people. Because for me, it's about that representation. And it's about when you read yourself represented on the page, or you see these incredible writers on the stage. And during our festival, some very famous writers, you know, and people like Val McDermott, where people are, oh, wow, you know, and then you think, you've done it, I can do it, you're really famous. And people have preconceived ideas of writers that they've all come from really good, affluent backgrounds. And many haven't. But yes, it is harder because, you know, you have to work that little bit harder because you maybe don't have the contacts. So for me, it's just kind of happened that I've become quite a contact for people, I suppose, into the publishing world. Like, we've just, you know, with London Book Fair, we've given away free tickets for people to come on certain days where they can come and access agents, editors, other writers. And that's, for me, that's really important, because then you know that you're part of this community and the representation of other working class writers. You know, again, it's taking that narrative away that you think, oh, it's not for me. People in my life are telling me to get a proper job. You know, it's not for you. It's not for us to be a writer. And for me, it's like, yes, it's a bit harder, but you absolutely can. So the more books are being written by working class writers, also that authentic voice in a lot of books that I like, you know, I think is really important. And it's not just the classic as people used to call it, poverty porn from a good few years ago, where that was just, those were the books that were about working class lives, because it's about positivity as well. It's about those women, like in my book, in our council estate, those incredible women who were just looked after us kids and laughed and were always playing music. And, you know, that real sense of community and happiness, which is a working class community. You know, that's really important for me to show that on the stage and on the page, so people can really see, you know, themselves represented in a positive light as well as a negative light sometimes.
Yes, because I feel like it would have been quite easy with the experiences you had to write quite a brutal book. But in actual fact, Undercurrent for me was very poetic, with the so much nature being brought in and descriptions. But also, we've already talked about your mum and her positivity and that community. And it did feel like there was hope and as you say, resilience, which was part of it. Like, is there a tendency that we have these stereotypical books? For me, your book stood out. And I just wondered, I'm not sure whether that's just because I haven't found others. But is there this, I often see this, well, we've talked about the poverty porn and these really brutal upbringings. But is there also a sense that life in rural areas is quite romanticised and we all have wonderful, happy lives and look at the beautiful views and that's enough?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely, because especially coming from Cornwall, and I really wanted to disperse that as well, because yes, it is beautiful in parts, not all parts, again, because people only go on a holiday to those coastal areas, and it's all very chocolate box and beautiful, and it is beautiful, as is, you know, the British Isles is beautiful. We live in a beautiful country, which we definitely have to spend more time protecting and looking after. But I also wanted to get across how rural, not just coming from rural poverty, but rural life is a lot harder for a lot of people. It's hard for a lot of young people because they can't access social groups. They maybe can't afford to, you know, you don't have a bus, you don't have a train running through. And if you don't have a car or access to a car, or, you know, it's that for many rural kids anyway. And then rural older people who are isolated, and as they don't get to get, you know, transport to bring them to a group once, even just once a week for 2 hours, the amount of cuts that councils are making. So for me, I really wanted to cover all those things too, because yes, whilst the countryside is beautiful, you can't feed your kids on a beautiful view, you know, and that, I just want people to remember that, to recognize that. And also when they come on holiday to Cornwall or any of our beautiful, you know, beautiful areas in the country, is to remember to do the small things. Maybe don't take the car sometimes. Maybe you travel by train. Maybe do a little bit of litter picking, or maybe stay in a, you know, on a campsite or in a yurt. You don't have to be kind of living in a muddy field. You can live in some, you can stay in some beautiful campsites, you know, but don't, maybe don't put the money into the Airbnbs, because when you do that, you obviously, those places are often then taken away from the local families who can't afford to live in the villages that they grew up in, you know. And then you've got this kind of cleansing of people, because all you've got in these houses, these villages, very much so in Cornwall, are second homes and Airbnbs. And in winter months, you've got, they're literally just dead. And the community, where is the community? So what people want is the community. And they're like, well, where are these people? Mm. You know, I know so many people in publishing, and they're like, they all see each other in our villages, on the coastal villages, because they're all going to holiday in the same places, you know, and they don't even mean to meet up. And I mean, how boring is that? Like, you're going on holiday, you're not hanging out with locals, you're hanging out with everybody else from London.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
I mean, that's like, it's not really good fun, is it? So,
yeah. And in your book, you bring in, again, there's the childhood and the beautiful descriptions of Cornwall, but you also bring in the facts and discussions about rural poverty and the challenges there. Was it always your intention that you wanted to weave all that into one book, or was that something that came up in the writing process?
Definitely what I wanted to do. Mm. Yeah. Before I spoke to anyone, I'd written out the kind of the pitch of what I wanted to do. I wanted to start every chapter with something from my childhood, my memoir going up from, you know, so it's literally from first memory, early memory, which is the first chapter, Blue Windows, right up until the last chapter, which is when I'm a teenager and I'm 19 and I'm leaving home. So But I knew those points in my life, obviously, and a lot of the bad things that happened. But the second half of every chapter really was the kind of the skeletal kind of map of the book, because I wanted to talk about transport. I wanted to talk about youth crime. I wanted to talk about the lack of opportunity for girls and women. I wanted to talk about male suicide. You know, all these things are so important to me as somebody growing up in a rural setting, you know, because it's these things that people don't really think about or don't really read about much, you know, and it's literally going under the skin of what it's like to live in the country. You know, we don't have the same opportunities as people in cities. And then when you talk about, you add poverty to that, people don't then think, people just think of high-rise estates in cities. And so, you know, I want to talk about growing up in a rural council estate and how different that is, you know, and the amount of feedback I've had from other people who have grown up on small council estates or have grown up with literally no public transport, who have grown up with the only one shop in the village. So my mum had to spend money in that one shop in the village, which was very expensive. And then in the summer, it was just astronomical prices because they had to sell the normal bread as some kind of artisan bread, put it in a paper bag, you know, pretend, you know, because to the tourists. And then for her, that's all we could buy was the local shop food because we didn't have a car. So we couldn't travel, like, you know.
Yeah. And as a child, when were you aware of the poverty and your life?
For me, I'm always very positive. So I was always very happy with whatever we were doing, like, you know, whether we were going for a walk on the beach, or my mum obviously did a lot of cleaning jobs around the village. We were often with her. So we often were in these big posh houses that were just, like, you know, very different from where we lived. But yeah, I didn't really, and not until I was playing. I have one chapter actually called Have and Have Nots, where I'm on the beach and there's these kids playing, and I'm playing in the rock pools, which I often did, messing around, and, you know, then kind of, we don't play with people like them because they're have nots. So that was the kind of the first moment when you think, oh, okay, what is have not? You are without. And for me, it was like, I'm not without. I have a loving mother, and I'm clean, and we're warm, and we're fed, and, you know, what little money she had just went on us, whereas my dad, obviously, what money he had went on drink and, you know, affairs and whatever else. Yeah. So it was quite a moment, really, because I think I'm rich, and for me, rich is a lot of things anyway, and, you know, and it's nature, and it's we had books, and they were from, you know, charity shops or jumble sales. We had the mobile library that came every 2 weeks. The mobile library was just incredible for us. That was just, you know, heaven. I always used to get fiction. My sister always got nonfiction. And then after the first week, we'd kind of swap around. But she never liked reading fiction. She always just wanted to read nature books and books about animals, which she still like. But people can bring people down just by being mean, or just, you know, comments like that, because these kids were like, they were from the rich area of the village, where it was literally mansions on the hill. We were the council estate at the foot of that hill.
And how's that feeling now? Like, you're a successful writer in many ways, I'm not just talking financial success, because I'm not sure many writers have huge amounts of that. But I mean, anyways, and do you feel like that background is still relevant, that there's still some doors that aren't fully opening, or there's still stereotypes, like, even now, years later?
I for me, because I'm a successful writer, I can kind of ask questions to do with the publishing world, and I'm kind of known for that. I don't care anymore. I'm just like, why are you not asking this question, especially like festivals? So they will invite somebody to a festival, and they will not. It's got a lot better, especially because I've been banging this drum since Class Festival. You know, that's what gave me the idea, was they would invite you to the festival, wouldn't tell you if you're being paid, wouldn't offer to pay for transport and accommodation if needed. So now if I ever see an email, people will pass things on to me, and I'll be like, this is not how you should do it, because you have to. You pay your bar staff at festival.
Yeah.
And if it's a literary festival, writers, you would expect, should be paid something, because that's the whole point of the festival. So yeah, I things like that really annoy me. But for me, I do get offered the things now because they know who I am. But I'm like, well, you know, you have to do it for everyone, because that's publishing is so middle class, and they are trying. It's no, everyone's lovely in publishing, sometimes too lovely, but it doesn't mean, but the thinking has to be always there. You have to put the invite out. You have to be able to think about, outside your circle of influence, what this person might need, because a lot of writers don't want to ask if they can get their travel paid for, because they think they might be uninvited from the festival or whatever the thing is that they want to travel to. I mean, for me, I didn't go to university, so I don't have contacts in that respect, but I have a billion contacts because of what I do. But I do understand a lot of writers don't, you know, it's not the case of, oh, your dad went to university with the editor of the Guardian books page, and so off you go. It's, you know, it's a shoo-in, because people got shoo-ins all the time. It's everywhere. People can't help it. But all I can say is just look outside. For me, like with the festival, or when I'm putting together panels, literary panels at events, nature panels, whatever, I always want to know, not the writers I already know, as much as I love them and I love their work, I want to know the writers I don't know. So I often say to people, who would you like to see at this festival? Or I say to publishing, who have you got? Who are you publishing that has got a new book out this year? What is it about? When I guest edited the bookseller, that's what all that was about. I wanted to know who the writers were, what the books were, what are people writing about. And I think we've come quite far now, because there are a lot more books written by working class writers, but we can still do more. But people from every corner of diversity. It's not just a tick box. You've got to keep doing it. You can't just say, oh, we've done that this year. Publishers do tend to do that. They know I don't, you know, I kind of argue this sometimes, because they will do their little diversity thing for a year, and then the money will disappear, whether it's to a class festival or if it's to do with any kind of corner of diversity. And also things like putting things online because of people who have disabilities who can't get to the places, or people who have childcare. They can't leave their kids somewhere and off they go, or they can't afford to travel to see an event. So for me, online events is really important as well, which is what we did at the end of last year with the Women's Prize, was to create opportunities for free for people who, you know, can't always get out of their house.
I mean, I spent years chronically ill, and when COVID and lockdown started, and suddenly I could attend poetry gigs and all these things, because it was suddenly inclusive, whereas before there was no chance that I could have got out the house.
Absolutely. And to keep that going is so important. Why can't we? And, you know, at Class Festival, we had a couple of events where we had them online as well as live. And we also had events when we had people literally on stage with another writer on the screen behind them, because they couldn't get, you know, and that's what it is. It's just thinking. And it's also not just thinking, what do people want? It's asking people what they want. You know, it's saying, what do you want? Because at the end of the day, walking up to an event online and listening and maybe asking questions to a writer that you really like or you're interested in, it's no different from having it on stage. You know, that's just kind of showy, really. You need to do the whole thing. But again, that's comes back to resilience, is thinking how we can make the world of publishing more resilient and all encompassing for everybody is so important.
And this activism and work that you do, just going back to resilience, when you talked about that upbringing and the easy option is to be bitter, angry, resentful, because it's just luck where we're born. And how do you think that you've managed to turn that into this activism and action and not sunk into the bitterness and the resentment?
I think because I did it, I want people to know how to do it. You can't teach people how to do something. You can't teach people to be positive as opposed to negative, but you can say, look, I've done it. People have done it. You can do it. You don't get anywhere from complaining. You don't get anywhere from just looking down and thinking, you know, and I know it's really hard for people, but at the same time, you know, I did it. I could have completely gone the other way. I could still be, you know, just in a prefab or living in the woods down in my home village, drinking like everyone else who's my age, who's still there, just getting old and not, and just complaining, you know, and it's just, I never wanted to do that. Soon as I could leave that village, I wanted to, because all the people around me, those people were like that, you know, and that's such a shame. I mean, so many girls have just got lots of babies, and so many lads have killed themselves. I mean, they've literally died in their 20s. And my mum often now will say, oh, you remember so-and-so? Well, you know, it's awful. And it's a lot of drug addiction and a lot of alcoholism. And I just think it is such a shame, because these are talented people, but they just, you know, they didn't have the opportunities, same as the way I didn't. But I don't know why I had to do everything to get out of that village, to get on, to meet other people and to write. So that's all I can say to people is, you know, you can, and it is hard, but you can do it. You have to be resilient to the things that hurt or the things that bring you down. But you have to kind of, I always say, you know, a lot of the doors aren't open. And sometimes you don't even know where the bloody doors are. Do you know what I mean? But if you can find a door and you can't open it and you try kicking it, or you maybe find a different door. What I do often, if I come up against something that's something I want and it's not happening, for me, I don't know if this is resilience or some kind of self-protection, but I didn't want it anyway. And I just completely pivot and I go and find something else. I'm always writing 2 or 3 books at the time. For me, that's how I do it. So you're not let down. It's kind of all the eggs in one basket, isn't it? If you get let down and your whole mind is just on one thing, you're going to be let down massively. If you've got a few things, you can just pivot and go and look at one of the other things and say, well, I didn't want that anyway. Maybe that wasn't for me. Maybe that editor wasn't for me. Maybe that publication wasn't for me. That's fine. I'm doing this anyway. And that's for me a form of resilience, because I haven't got time to be let down. I haven't got time to be sad about the thing I didn't get or whatever. I'm just like, oh, okay, let's just move on. This over here is much better anyway. So yeah, and that's worked for me.
I wondered how much you thought creativity was part of resilience. Like, there's so much creativity in your book, whether that's from your mum or taking you just finding those beautiful things, finding the joy in life, and obviously your own writing. And I just, going back to that hope, that positivity, do you feel like creativity is part of that as well?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, because you can then just shift around. Like, you know, I've got ADHD as well, so I'm just like, I've got lots of things because I get bored of one or two things. So if that one thing bores me or that's not happening, but that's part of the creative mind, is I find it easy to move from one project to another because I'm creative. And for me, because of being such a nature writer and spending so much time in nature, I write all my books outside, which is very much a part of my attention. People think, how can you do that when you're attention? I'm like, that works for my attention. My worst nightmare is sitting in front of a laptop typing up my notes. So I write all my books I've written longhand outside. And the hard bit is you're typing and, you know, because I'm distracted and there's your phone and there's, you're playing music and then you think, oh, I might run the vacuum round because the carpet's a bit dirty. Like anything. My distraction indoors is just like, is as off the charts. Outside, yeah, I might all of a sudden start doing a bit of weeding in the garden or something, but I'm still writing. It's a different part of my mind. So yeah, that creativity has really helped me to just, to move through life in a kind of a fractal way. Chaotic, I suppose, but then that gets the work written.
But then how you've just described your writing seems like the opposite of what school is like, where you are told to sit down and be quiet and things. Like, do you feel in any way? Do you feel in any way like failed by the system in school, in
absolutely.
That we just push everybody into the same box?
Yeah, I absolutely did. Yeah. I know schools are a lot better now. And I, you know, my partner's a teacher. I understand that they do what they can for all kids. But for me, yeah, as back in the, you know, the 90s or whatever, you just in the 80s, you're just staring out my window, and they didn't want to engage me, you know. Well, I loved sport, so I was always watching the sport out the window, because I was just sport mad, sport and art, like those are my things, and writing. So yeah, I love learning about stuff now, like history and geography. I'm like, wow, you know, like, and so it might be like those simplest things, but for me, I was like, I missed all that at school. Missed all that. Science was like, what was that? You know, because I was just in the low set, because I was in a low set for maths, which meant you had to be in the low set for everything. So that wasn't a great start. So yeah, I was always just creating stories, and then I'd be messing around and doing comedy acts and things like that at the back of the class. Just anything other than what I'm supposed to be doing. But I do feel I was let down. But, you know, but instead of going, oh, boo-hoo, I'm like, well, you know, I had fun. In my last year, I used to write songs on my guitar. I mean, my friend, we'd go down the park and be singing songs. And, you know, I wanted to be a rock star. Well, I wanted to be a country singer. And so we were writing these songs, which were literally just poems I wrote. And we would just sing the lines. Like, they weren't great songs at all. Just sing like a verse over and over and over, which was just poetry.
And those, yeah, they're kind of...
I love school. People are like, oh, did you like... I love school, but not for the reasons everybody else loves school. I love school because it was just like... great fun, because I came from a tiny village. You had the 10-mile bus ride into a town, and then yeah, you know, it was all these different people and just fun. Yeah, but that's all part of my becoming a writer, I suppose, because I love writing with fiction. Well, also with memoir, actually. I love dialogue, and I love watching people interact and stuff, and I think that came from quite an early age as well, just watching people.
Yeah, I think you talk in the book about the women coming round into the kitchen and just listening,
gossiping, yeah, gossiping. And somebody's pregnant and whose is it, and yeah, and it's also the unsaids, isn't it? It's not just what people are saying, it's literally just watching their expressions and body language. I always say to people, if they want to learn how to learn dialogue, sit and watch someone, like go out in your local park or wherever you are and watch two people from afar, and don't, so you out earshots, you can't hear them, but just watch the body language. It's so interesting. And also when I hate reading other people's dialogue often, because they always end the sentence, and most people don't end a sentence, and we repeat words, and we talk over each other. So for me, in my writing, I always try and get that in, because that's how we speak.
And just going back to the childhood and resilience, and we often say, oh, children are so resilient. And I suppose at the end of Undercurrent, you're leaving as a teenager, and that could be a story of resilience. But then you mention, or you hint at like a hospital admission and anger and things later in your life that aren't covered in the book. And I just wondered if we're a bit too complacent or naive about how resilient children are, and if actually what you experienced as a child, both with the poverty and just your experiences in the home, like, is that something that's carried with you? How resilient do you feel about those?
You do carry it with you. Yeah, absolutely. And I have a lot of friends, other writers who have had similar backgrounds, worse backgrounds, gone through a lot. And as children, people always think if you have at least one available adult, you can move away, and you can get better, and you can grow, and you can have normal relationships with people and stuff. But you don't forget the things that you've seen, and the older you get, they will come back at some point. I think for me is probably abandonment, my dad's abandonment, which a lot of people have. But it is, you know, there's loads of us that have abandonment issues, because you literally are like, what did I do wrong as a child? But then my resilient mind is like, you are the failure, not me. You know, so anyone can kind of, you can ask those questions with your child mind. But as you get older, you're like, well, no, definitely, obviously, you leave a child, you abandon a child, you don't want anything to do with that child. That's your problem. It's not my problem. So there, you have to be resilient to those things, because you know that some people mess up, or people have addictions and then they can't be there for their children, or they become very, you know, selfish, or and their violence and everything else. There's nothing really you can do, but you do remember those things. And the older you get, you have to remember that it wasn't your fault, you know, and that's resilience. And that's the kind of the grown up part of your brain as well. But yeah, we all have moments when we, like, you know, you kind of lose it, you lose your way, and then you have to pull it back and say, okay, I've messed up there. I need to build back and build back better.
And processing and coming to an acceptance on those things, has your writing been a big part of that? I'm thinking particularly in those, the fiction and how these themes have come up in those books as well.
Yeah, it does, because, you know, that's the thing of being a writer. You have to bring yourself in to all your work. You can't, it's just natural, you know. So every character in all my work will have a part. I will have a part in them and they'll have a part in me. But yeah, it's a way of working through, I think, as well. Yeah, you do work through stuff when you're working a character out and you're maybe putting them into situations, or you're walking them through trauma, literally. You know what the outcome's going to be, but also you have to think about other people who find it harder to get through certain trauma, and how they have reached different parts in their lives. Or, you know, it's for all of us, it's definitely a journey. For me, in books, that is the journey. I mean, all my characters pretty much are on a physical journey, and they're out walking in the storms, and they're, you know, they're getting somewhere. And even if the ending might not always seem hopeful at first, every story does end in hope. It might be a hard ending, but it's also, there is always some kind of light for the characters. And I think that's really important. Yeah.
And yeah, I think also, like, I used to work for 14 years was a lawyer with children in prison and care. And there was hope, there was light moments, there was compassion in those cases, which often mirror quite similar backgrounds to yours as well. And then writing the memoir, was that something that just felt at the right time? Was it something that you'd been working on for a while? It just feels like you couldn't have written that memoir when you were 19 and heading off.
Yeah, it's exactly, yeah. Yeah, I just had the thought. I just started thinking about it. I just thought, I really want to write. And it came from all the politics of what was happening in the country, you know. And I just thought, God, there's so much unfairness. And I kept bringing it back to myself. So I thought, I'm going to do this nonfiction, which is literally, it's memoir, but it's also, it's a social commentary. I really wanted to kind of weave those two things together. And people say, oh my God, is it hard to write a memoir? I've never written a book so quickly and just loved every minute of it. I don't know, maybe that's my massive ego, but I love writing, not just about myself, but just, it just worked. Like it all just gelled, you know, and I really enjoyed it. For me, it was, as I love writing fiction, but it just needed to come at the time it came. You know, and my new book that I'm working on at the minute is nonfiction. So I'm.
And does it follow later in life? Do we get more memoir, please?
That's kind of on the back shelf. There is an idea there for the second memoir to follow on from this one. But what I'm writing at the moment, yeah, is nonfiction. I've really just got into writing in that certain way, because I think it's helped being a poet from childhood and fiction writer, that I don't see, for me, as a poetic nature writer in nonfiction, that is still there. That was always in my fiction, poetry and nature writing. And that's the same in my nonfiction. So I'm just like, well, this is, you know, it feels right for me. And then the socialist, you know, the socialism side, and that comes through, the activism comes through in nonfiction and fiction, but yeah. I'm writing fiction as well. I'm just like,
of course, don't put all your eggs in one basket.
I've got three books on the go. My agent's just like, what?
Will you just sit down and do one?
Just sit down one for a minute.
And we talked about the publishing industry, and you were saying that there are, it might be quite slow, but there's moves there. But when I look at the wider society that we're in at the moment, it feels really bleak until we can get this Conservative government out. Like, yeah. The inequalities are growing, the poverty is growing. Like, how do you cope with that? How do you still have positivity? Do you still find hope in that?
I do, because people are lovely, and I think people sometimes forget that. It's so easy for us when we have things going on in our own lives to step outside your door and you kind of think everybody is, you know, you've got to have compassion and think maybe if somebody's not very nice to you in the supermarket, for example, that they maybe are having a bad day because their bottle is full, you know, and they're fizzing. And that's and sometimes we all have to just be compassionate towards each other. It's really important now more than ever to think of the things that we have in common as opposed to the things that we don't, especially since Brexit. People have literally gone into two camps. And nobody looks at grey areas anymore. Nobody really kind of, it's like, oh, you're like that, or we're like that. You are, you know, you're woke, we're like, and it's just the whole thing. I really think people need to talk to each other because we're all different. And there's sometimes it's not good to think we're all the same in a certain pot. You know, people who might not have the same politics as you, they might still be lovely. They might still be nice. It's just how their life has been for them to get to the decisions they have made, or they have aligned themselves to a certain political party. But I do have hope because people are genuinely good and nice and okay, you know, and I think we just need to not forget that. We need to just have empathy that perhaps sometimes people have had a bad day or their childhood has been very different to yours and that's why they think a certain way. But yeah, I will always have faith that we will get there in the end. Yeah, we've definitely hit a rock bottom for a minute. And because especially internationally, we get all this too much information, and sometimes I don't think our brains can cope with so much kind of negativity and sadness, because we go from where we live and then it's national and it's international and it's also instant. Now our heads are just like, oh my God, so much. And people, and you know, and then people just go around really sad, obviously, because so much sadness is happening. But if we can just do a few good things and a few nice things, then, you know, perhaps we can turn it around in our small circle of influence. And then, yeah, it's that's all we can do. But I have hope for people, because people are actually, we've all got good hearts, really. And that's what we have to remember.
Yeah. And I was just, that information overload. I remember, I think it was in some of your writing, you talked about going to the sea and it just calming all that down.
I think
in Undercurrent you said that nature has an impact just on our brain, bodies, behavior, everything. I mean, do you still feel that? Do you, even if you can't live by the sea and can't live in your old places, are you still soothed by nature? Are you still inspired by it? Like, what does that
mean?
Absolutely.
I mean I've just been on a walk for an hour this morning in the rain, because for me that's great. That's the start of the day. It's brighter outside, you know, it's all about biophilia. You just think, wow, this is, you know, I love being in nature, because it's just, that has always calmed me down and, you know, sorted any thought. My mum always used to say, any thought, any argument, take it outside, you know, and you can walk with your partner and just have a massive row whilst you're walking on the coast path, and then that's sorted, you know, and I love that. Yeah. I'm not one for walls and being inside. You know, I really find it quite hard to be indoors for long.
In terms of
your
life,
experience again, as you know, you just get out in the storm and you say, of course, because I don't want that to stop me doing what I want to do, because I want to go for a nice hike. So I'm going to get out in that weather and job done, really, you know, and then that's the rest of the day is waiting or whatever and outside and
Yeah. Yeah, and I think for me, I grew up in quite a large family and a noisy house. So getting outside for me was that pocket of quietness as well, and solitude and time to think. Like, yeah, as a nature writer, I definitely can see that there's been such an underrepresentation of different backgrounds and people in nature writing. How important do you think that is? Because I kind of then think, well, nature's nature, isn't it? Are we all just seeing nature? It's the same for everyone. But yeah. Why is it important that we have different voices talking about it?
Yeah, well, the reason why I set up the Nature Writing Prize for working class writers was really a lot of working class writers don't think of themselves as nature writers. We've got this thing of, you know, the white posh man with his cap on and he's lamenting about the birds and the trees and, you know, well, isn't it beautiful? And then he goes home. For me, it's dirty. It's dirt beneath your fingernails. It's rough and ready. And it could be the nature of, you know, you could be on a council estate, you could be in a park, you could be obviously in Cornwall where I am or where you are, but we can just, nature is everywhere. And I wanted people to kind of embrace nature writing and take away that, because we're all nature writers. If you want to be a nature writer, and so many people over the years, like this year is the fifth year of our Nature Writing Prize. People say, oh, it's not for me. I'm not a nature writer. That's for posh people. You know, they call it the Robert McFarlane table at Waterstones. It's that table at the front of the shop. And it's literally just 99% of white men. You know, black people are not working, are not nature writers. What the whole thing, whether it's from a class perspective or whatever, nature writing for some reason has just been pigeonholed into this really posh kind of, you know, super club that nobody else is allowed in, not even women. I mean, it's ridiculous. So yeah, I just want everyone to just be writing about nature, where they live and who they are. And again, we go back to, you know, maybe you can't go out into nature, but you could maybe use, you know, if you're housebound or whatever, you can look out, you can see the birds or the sky, you can maybe see what's growing in your window box, even if it's just a couple of herbs or whether there's a weed. Like, it's literally, you know, I want people to write about nature and then the nature of us as well. And combine those two things. It comes back to me as a child thinking, okay, nature is me and I am nature, and having that moment on the beach with the storm and thinking, I'm so angry, and looking at the angry storm and going, oh, okay, we are, you know, we are one. That's the thing. And that's what I want everyone to do with nature writing. I want just to own it, really, because it's about time.
Yeah, you're hoping there's a time where you don't need a separate festivals or separate awards for people from a working class background. Is that the aim, that we can just be nature writers or writers?
Yeah, because I never wanted to ghettoize us. You know, I wanted us to, I wanted people to recognize us. And then, you know, and I have done in the last couple of years, we've done a lot of festivals now where I've toured I've just been asked to, because of my book being out, different festivals where you're on a panel and you have been chosen because your book is good and there's a couple of you, and maybe you're there because you're working class writers, or you're there because you're nature writers, or you're there because just your book's bloody brilliant. You know, it could be anything, but that's what I want. I just want people to just start looking at all the writers, as opposed to, I mean, certain festivals, it's just famous people.
Yeah.
And they're not writers. They're just famous people that has had their book, their life story ghostwritten by a writer. And I just, those kind of festivals just really annoy me, because I'm like, okay, maybe you need a couple of those to get the money in, but also get the writers in as well, because it's a bit hard for a lot of writers, you know, especially ones early in their career to be invited to festivals and be invited on podcasts or be invited to talk on Radio 4 or whatever, because, you know, but they might have something really valid to say that taps into what people are thinking about at that time. So yeah, I think, you know, producers definitely as well need to kind of think about the bigger picture, because some people might only just started out in their career and have a book out that nobody knows about, but it might be an incredible book and they might be an incredible speaker. And, you know, and this is what we need to do. It's just thinking about who's out there instead of just thinking, oh, that person will do.
Yeah. Who do I know?
I mean, I'm often invited to things now, anything to do with working class writing, you know. Which is great, but I'm like, there's other people as well.
I'm not the only one in the country.
Yeah, I don't mind, but that literally doing the thing that I'm kind of saying don't do, in a way, because there's, you know, there's lots of brilliant working class writers, new ones, different from different backgrounds within the banner of working class. So yeah, it's important to just get those different variety of voices out there. It's interesting for everyone to listen and to read.
Yeah, definitely. I agree. Thank you. So you've hinted a bit about what you're working on, a few things. Is there any more that you can tell us about that? And is it this year that the festival comes back as well?
I'm hoping that at the end of this year, we're still looking for funding. But yeah, now it's all kind of the paperback for Undercurrent, which is out 11th of April. So that's really exciting. We've got a new cover. We've got a cover reveal coming up.
Cover for the hardback that I've got is absolutely stunning.
Gorgeous, yeah, it really is. It's a Cornish artist, actually. It's really good. We're just working on the new tour. So I'll definitely be around the country, festivals and whoever wants me.
And how do we follow you as well, Natasha?
Yeah, oh, absolutely, yeah. I'm always on social media, probably too much. That's why I write outside, so I can get away from my phone. Yeah,
yeah, I know.
For work.
Yes, I think I started following you on Twitter. I can't remember when, a long time ago, but really interested in everything that you promote, and that was before Undercurrent came out. So
that's brilliant. Well, thanks for talking. It's been brilliant.
Oh, it's been so nice to talk to you. I've got your other books. I got them out of the library, but because of various cancellations, I haven't had my lovely week recovery from my surgery to sit and read them. But as the snow falls, I might tuck myself up with a book in a little bit and start reading those. I just wanted to say, like I said, they were young adult, but for me, that doesn't stop me reading them. I mean, is that a bit of a barrier for some adults to say, oh, I don't want to read a young adult fiction?
Because yeah, probably. I mean, my first three books with Bloomsbury. The first one was Winter Damage, and it was 50-50 if it would be literary fiction or young adult. I mean, the word young adult is a marketing ploy, yeah, that is just kind of kept. But yeah, it was meant to be literary fiction. I just certainly didn't write it for children. And we had to edit it. I had to take out 50 fucks.
Is that the difference between young adult and adult?
They're like, you have to take out all this swear. Oh, that's brilliant. That's fine. And then that was there. So you could see the places, because I'm like, oh my God, what word am I going to have to use instead? It's a really good kind of
an exercise.
Like other words. Yeah, an exercise. But when you read it, you'll know when they're like, damn, you'll know about this.
Oh, yeah. Thank you so much for your time, Natasha.
No worries. Brilliant.
Thank you for listening to the Resilience Rising podcast. If you have enjoyed this episode, please do help people find us by hitting subscribe, leaving a review, or sharing us with others. Thank you so much, and see you next time on the Resilience Rising podcast.